Hi, Anjan. Thank you so much for coming to talk to us about dinosaurs, about feathers, about everything.
That's my absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So, you got to see and got to be involved with and got to have a say in and advise on so many different dinosaurs throughout this series. Like, what has been, you know, some of the best things about working on this documentary and some of the best animals that you got to introduce us to?
Well, my God, ground level. The great fundamental thing about working on this program is that when we started, we were brought in very early on, and I ended up communicating with Dan Tapster, the showrunner, and the writers and directors quite a lot through the process. But even from the beginning, it was clear that we had the same overall vision for telling the story of life on Earth as sort of a grand, almost mythic narrative, and providing a sense to people of the incredible fortune that human beings have to exist today, right? And the beauty and connectivity of everything around us. And so the goal with showing the creatures that were around at various times in the history of Earth was to be as accurate as possible from the ground up. And this is something that you don't always see with productions, large-scale productions like Life on Our Planet. But they wanted to build every animal truly from the inside out, starting with hyper-accurate skeletons, then moving on to muscles and tendons, and finally over those, draping the skin and other soft tissues. And so that back and forth with the Silverback Films people and with the Industrial Light and Magic VFX teams was so rewarding in so many ways, because they were hungry for as many data as possible on the precise forms and functions of all of these creatures.
How does that work for you as an academic? You've got your day job. You've got to, you know, be in university. You're at Yale. You're dealing with students. They've all got projects. You're writing your own papers. You're doing lectures. And then you've got a documentary that took, God, how many years was it? Like four years to make.
Yeah.
And they're coming to you. They're asking you all these questions. Like, can you tell us what this looks like? What that looks like? Please, can you talk to the animators and the model makers? And how do you fit that in?
You fit it in around everything else. I mean, you know, as a fellow academic, how much of one's time is spent with graduate students, undergrads, committees, teaching. But actually, my great love, perhaps, is teaching, and teaching our big introductory lecture course here, which is pitched in part to non-majors, and so it's pitched to sort of a general audience, and it's called The History of Life. And I never feel that I'm doing something more important than when I'm up in front of those 60, 70 students, telling them, you know, and for many of them, they're being told for the first time about our long march through the ages of the world and the way in which the planet now represents a product. It represents the final, or the current, rather, current existence of what is actually a series of worlds, in a way, a series of lost worlds that are just built one on top of another. The revelation that some of the students have or experience when our place is fully explained in the grand scope of things, it's so rewarding to see. And I feel that it's really important. It's telling people something fundamental about themselves and about our world. And so, given that one feels that way with 60 or 70 Yale students, imagine the sense of importance when you're given the opportunity to influence telling of the story that will reach, you know, how many subscribers does Netflix have? You know, I mean, thousands and thousands of people. And so it's, you know, it was a lot of late nights. It was a lot of really early morning phone calls since they're in the UK. But the drive to do it was so strong. Rarely does one get an opportunity to affect so many, potentially to affect so many people.
And it's a wonderful thing that we're putting that out up front and center. And it's something that we could easily lose sight of, is that, you know, as we're going to be here trying to unpack more of the science, trying to go into more depth, trying to look at the science behind the things that we've seen, that, you know, we are just a very small part of the audience, the part that are really incredibly well familiar with paleontology and these kinds of conversations where we're talking about details, where we're talking about the science and how that's represented. That is just going to be a small part of it. But the biggest part is that new audience are the people who are going to learn a lot just from watching all of this, all of these stories, all of these animals that they might not be overly familiar with. So that's really important, I feel.
That's right. Yeah. Although I do think that people in general, no matter what their level of expertise about anything, have an intuitive feeling for the amount of care that was put into anything, whether it's a dish at a restaurant or a television show, right? And I would hope, I think that the fingerprints of the huge number of people who cared very much about getting the details right for this show are there, you know, plain to see.
Yeah. And podcasts. Don't forget podcasts.
Yes, and podcasts.
People work very hard on those.
Oh, I'm a great consumer of podcasts. Oh, yes.
Good. Right. So we better start with some dinosaurs. We've got a lot of people who are going to be very interested in the stories that you've shown, the different genera that you've collectively decided to go for. So what were some of those discussions like when you were deciding what to actually show and what you could in fact show?
Yeah, I mean, as far as what we could show, sort of the sky was the limit, right? We started off talking about things like how to show the last common ancestor of all life, right? How to show a single cell and its internal complexity and so on. But as far as the vertebrate portions and the dinosaur portions, the idea was to hit a series of points in time that would demonstrate the full flowering of diversity in this case during the Paleozoic and the Mesozoic. And so we went back and forth about those, and some of them are classic scenes, like we have, of course, the late Cretaceous of the U.S. because we wanted to tell that story and the story of the extinction, and then connect that to modern animals in a way that isn't done as commonly in such documentaries. But the middle portions, we just sort of thought about what characters were really compelling. I mean, Deinonychus. Compelling, interesting, relevant to popular culture, and relevant also to the history of science on dinosaurs, for instance. As far as the greatness of that particular dynasty, one I think can't escape delving a little bit into the Jurassic of the Western U.S. Right, the Morrison. There's no other place that preserves the time of Titans like that does. But it was all open. It was all kind of, at the beginning, back and forth. What should we do? Where should we go?
Yeah, so I've just spoken to Barney, and hopefully everyone's just listened to me talking to him about the attention to detail that went into some of those scenes, particularly the Allosaurus reigning scene and the Deinonychus hunt scene with its feathers and how much effort went into the visuals. So it's great to have that view, that effort, that that representation, that believability in the stories that we see. So concentrating on the feathers, though, because that's something that I wanted to explore further, because we kind of jump over feather evolution pretty quickly. We see a juvenile Deinonychus with some kind of like fluffy, feathery things. It sort of looked like my cat. And then we saw Deinonychus and Archosaurus with like bigger feathers. We see T-Rex with kind of like quills or spikes or something like that. So before we look at those in detail, can we just get an overview of the different types of feathers that we have today and what they're used for?
Yeah, right. So the set of feathers that exists on living dinosaurs is obviously a, just as living dinosaurs are a small subset of the enormous arborescence that is the whole of Dinosauria, right? They're just one twig that survived and then flourished. The existing set is kind of a subset of what has existed. But because birds have such high diversity, there are a number of different forms that are present in the living taxa, right? So the primary types are, you have to not only look from species to species, but you have to track an individual throughout its life to really understand the diversity of these things. Because, for instance, bird chicks tend to have the very soft, downy feathery coating before they develop anything further. And that seems purely to function in insulation, which was probably the ancestral function of feathers. And then as they grow, they start shedding that and the more adult type feathers come in. And effectively, there are feathers that cover the body that seem to have mostly an insulation function. Although I should say also, every single feather is individually innervated. And this is something that's sort of special to feathers, which means that that birds can detect very, very subtle changes in wind or pressure or anything else that's going on all over their body. And the part of the brain that's developed for the reception of these sensations is also hugely expanded in birds. So every single feather, whatever its locomotor or insulation function, is also an extremely sensitive sensory receptacle.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so that's a fundamental thing about feathers that is probably present from the beginning. And it relates to how they are formed in the embryo, but every one of them has a specific single point of innervation, and their exact direction, orientation, how much pressure they're under, all of that stuff is carried back, and there's a cortical map on the brain of all of those feathers everywhere in the body, right? They're like sort of like the whiskers in mammals, but it's all over the body. So dinosaurs, everything that had feathers, everything that has feathers now, have this enormously expanded sensory landscape compared to reptiles, and actually in a lot of ways compared to mammals too. So that's one thing that people often don't talk about. Ornithologists who study living birds know this, right? But this is one of the things that I really lament about paleontology. I think people really, if you want to be best paleontologist you can be, if you're interested in things like the lives of animals, you need first to be fully trained in biology. And you need to try and be trained from the biochemistry all the way up. You've got to learn physiology, histology, every level of tissue organization. And from there, you can reach back into the past. But yeah, that's an aspect of feathers that isn't as well appreciated, and I think, you know, probably has a good deal to do with brain elaboration and intelligence in birds as well. But there are, otherwise, there are feathers that cover the body in birds. They tend to be streamlined along the body surface, and one could easily see that as something that was under a lot of selection pressure owing to the huge demands of complex flight, right? That sort of a necessity of flying, and the body feathers otherwise are pretty clearly their insulation. They can raise them and lower them to signal and so on. And then there are the flight feathers that are on the wings, which really means that they're extending from the palms and fingers of the hands and the base of the forearm. And those are the airfoils when they fly. Those are very sophisticated instruments in and of themselves. Every one of them can move independently, right? That's the other thing. Feathers are also, each one of them has a series of muscles attached so that they can be repositioned. And then the feathers on the tails of modern birds also seem to be kind of a separate thing. And those are used during flight, but also, as most of us know, for various functions and signaling and so on as well.
So when do we actually see the first evidence for feathers in the fossil record? And in which group or groups did they evolve? And which of the feathers that we've just talked about do they most closely resemble, if any?
The origin of something like feathers is always going to be the questions of the origin of feathers are always going to be a bit in flux, because feathers are not typically preserved in fossils, right? One has to have special conditions to preserve something that's as delicate and as subject to decay as a feather. However, dinosaurs, including birds, are a part of a great radiation of reptiles called the archosaurs, or ruling reptiles. And the two big branches of archosauria are, on the one hand, the crocodiles and the alligators today, and on the other hand, the birds. And then there are all of these extinct things that were arrayed along the kind of the lineages up to the modern forms. And the ancestor looks something like a little dinosaur. But as far as we can tell, there's no evidence for anything like a feather. It scales all the way up on the crocodile side. On the bird side, however, some of the earliest branches off of that lineage are things like pterosaurs. Interesting, right? That's that branch, that lineage seems to just want to develop flight over and over again. For a long time, it was sort of known that at least some pterosaurs might have had a kind of a hairy coat on them, because of a few exceptionally preserved fossils from various places in Europe and Asia. But there wasn't a lot of evidence for feathery structures in dinosaurs at the time, just speculation. But now the more we've found, the more we realize that just about everything on that entire bird line, the dinosaurs, pterosaurs, and everything else, seems to have had some form of feathery covering. And in fact, pterosaurs, which I, as I said, are pretty early branches off of that line, have a bunch of different forms of feathers. So they have simple, straight, filamentous, hair-like things, which, you know, you want to imagine that it's some sort of a really logical evolutionary progression. Like, well, first there were ones that were just straight, and then they got one branch, and then they got two branches, you know, and then they got four branches. But so far, that doesn't really seem to be the case. In pterosaurs already, there are things that are just straight like hairs. There are feathers, or, you know, proto feathers, whatever you want to call them, that have multiple branches. There are even things that seem to have maybe a single central branch with a few filaments coming off of them. They're tufts. They're all kinds of forms of these things. And then you find various morphologies all over the place within the dinosaurian tree too. The only thing that you that seems restricted to a smaller group that includes birds are the true pinnaceous, what we now think of sort of as flight feathers, which are the things that are characterized by having a single central shaft with the characteristic symmetrical or slightly asymmetrical branches coming off of it.
So we've got those ones in pterosaurs then. Is there a how do we go from those to something like we see on screen with Deinonychus, where you can when you can start to see that it's really starting to look a bit more bird-like and a lot more feather-like, like we would imagine them today?
As far as we can tell, the big thing that happened in one branch of the dinosaur tree was the advent of those pinnaceous, classic, what we now think of as flight feathers on the arms. And exactly where those come in isn't precisely clear, but we have a pretty good idea that they appeared around where these animals called oviraptors branched off of the line toward birds. And so the evolutionary group that includes the oviraptors and birds and everything in it, at least minimally, seems to have had these elaborated feathers on long dexterous arms that were clearly pretty heavily muscled. I mean, the animal as it developed invested a good deal into its forelimbs and all of these creatures, and the hands were highly adapted for some kind of a grasping function too. So that's where they come in. And then there's this open question, of course, about what were they doing with those really elaborate long arms that bore modern seeming feathers. I mean, there's a bit of there's an idea that to have a true flight feather, you have to have a slightly asymmetrical feather on your arm. And that has to do with the aerodynamics of powered flight, right? And it is true that the earliest forms of these things seem to be more symmetrical. On the other hand, I think that this might be a forest and trees kind of situation, where just by having these big fans of feathers on their arms, all of these animals would have been able to do something with them as they ran or as they jumped, right? So the level of aerial ability that they had is still, I think, up for debate. But you know, when something exists on an animal's body, an animal will do something with it, right? And it'll come up more often than not, because animals are often, or you know, in the most important moments of their lives, they're in extremis and they have to do everything they can, either to chase down prey or to survive or whatever else. So I'm sort of a maximalist opinion on whether this entire group of dinosaurs includes oviraptors, velociraptor, Deinonychus, modern birds, etc., had some level of aerial ability. I think they all probably did. And all of them ancestrally were very small. They were small enough to be quite agile and to be aloft for a fair bit of time, even if they were just gliding.
Well, we're going to be talking hopefully a bit more about flight and birds and the differences between dinosaurs and birds and when flight evolved in the next episode. But for this one, is it right to think that, seeing as we've got feathers in pterosaurs. If we follow this branch of the tree of life with birds here in the present, follow it all the way back in throughout all of its branches, we eventually get to all these other dinosaurs that have branched off it and to the pterosaurs. Did everything on this branch have some feathery thing going on? Like, what happens with, say, Triceratops? Is that feathered? Stegosaurus? Diplodocus? Are all of these things feathery? Is it right to think that they had the ability to have feathers? And if they didn't, then it was something that they've lost, rather than just looking at the things that have feathers and saying, yes, everything's gained it.
Yep. Right. I mean, the boring answer, of course, is for a lot of those taxa, because they weren't preserved in the right environments, we don't know whether they had feather-like appendages. But I'm not going to give the boring answer. I'm just going to go out on a limb. Yeah. Yes. They all had feathers. Every single one. I would bet $20.
Wow.
That they all, every single one, everyone had somewhere on its body, even if it's, you know, in the same way that elephants have hair, for instance. I would be willing to bet about $20, maybe 20 pounds sterling, that every one of them had some kind of feathery bit.
little bit more expensive, isn't it? Wow, we're getting a deal here. Is this for all the Netflix audience?
I'll have to check on you know, my finances.
Yeah, check your balance first.
I'm gonna just go out, and predict that. You know, we know that there was some kind of a scaly type skin on at least some places on some of these dinosaurs, right? But even skin that looks like scales, and so when one says scales, or when one says scale, it actually can mean a number of different things. And the fact is that something like a lizard scale is a very particular object as far as how it develops at a molecular level and so on and so forth. But even bird skin that has feathers coming out of it, if you were to just take like a latex cast or something of that skin, or a plaster cast, a good deal of it would look like the so-called scaly skin that people describe for dinosaurs, right? So without more detail than just the surface texture, we don't even know whether much of that scaly skin that people have found on various dinosaur skeletons might itself have had feathers coming out of it.
What is the evidence for feathers then in the fossil record? I mean, obviously with something like Archaeopteryx, where you can actually see the feathers in the fossil. So for instance, if we were looking at a pterosaur, or if we were looking at, I don't know, something that has more smaller downy feathers, is there any evidence for that? Where would we look for it? And because a lot of the time we're just looking at bones. Bones don't have feathers growing out through the skin of them, do they?
A few of them have apparent imprints that from feather quills, but that comes up pretty late, right? No, there are a few places on Earth that preserve organisms, extinct organisms, in such exceptional way that you can see the so-called soft tissues, right? Many of those are, for instance, the famous lake beds in China, ancient lake beds in China, the, as you said, the lithographic limestones of Germany that produced Archaeopteryx. There are a few others, a few in North America. There's now some amber that preserves also actual feathers, and we have enough species now that have the feathers upon them preserved, that we can see they were broadly distributed across all of the dinosaur tree and in pterosaurs.
So what other kinds of information can we get from feathers?
Yeah, it's actually pretty amazing. When feathers are preserved, right, that denotes already some kind of extraordinary type of fossilization. And it turns out that one can glean at least some information about the actual the coloration and the pattern of colors on the body of an organism from preserved feathers. And so researchers have been able to do that with a series of dinosaurs. And the reason we're able to infer some things about at least patterns of light and dark and so on in extinct dinosaurs is that certain kinds of pigment that were once encapsulated within the cells that compose skin structures like feathers are fairly resistant to decay. And in particular, there are structures called melanosomes, in which is the black pigment melanin, which is a general vertebrate pigment that makes creates darkness in any kind of skin. Melanin, you know, it has, in all vertebrates, it has a sort of protective function. It protects against UV radiation, other forms of radiative damage, and it also seems to have a structural protective function. And so you can imagine, because of that, it's actually it's pretty resistant to decay. It's sort of a heavily armored molecule. And that's why it tends to be preserved.
If we are preserving molecules, if we're preserving things within cells, doesn't that mean that we have the rest of the cell there with it for it to be preserved into? And if we've got the rest of the cells, you know, we've got a perfectly complete 100% there body. Like, how can we have something preserved that's in a cell?
Yeah, wouldn't that be great? Unfortunately, that's doesn't seem to be the case. You know, a cell is an extremely complex structure in and of itself. And much of its composition is layers of fat and what I would call sort of fragile proteins that make up the cell's skeleton. And those are susceptible to degradation from all kinds of sources, whether it's just acid, acidic, or basic water passing through, or whether it's the actions of microorganisms. So all of that can break down, and you can be left with just the most resistant parts. I mean, in a way that's analogous to the preservation of the bones while the rest of the body breaks down.
Okay, and in this episode, we see a touch of iridescence on the Deinonychus. In the next episode, we're seeing Anchiornis, and that's got different colors. It's got red on it. So right. how do we, I mean, if we're getting, you know, like black pigment or an absence of black pigment, how then do we decide, wait, this is red, this is shiny? I mean, you look at the modern birds today, they come in every shape, color, size of feather. Like they're beautiful. They feathers are mottled, feathers have shiny bits. You only have to think of a peacock to see some of the different colors that you can get. So how can we recreate colors if all we've got is a binary, it's black or it's not black?
Yeah. So in fact, there are hints of other pigments that are preserved in at least some dinosaur fossils. So the red crest in Anchiornis, there is a hint of, I believe, carotenoid pigmentation that sits there, which suggests that at least part of the base color was kind of a brownish orange sort of thing. And there are some signatures of iridescence in at least some fossil feathers too. So, I mean, all of these things appear to have been present in various forms in various taxa. Now, the one thing is that to keep in mind, of course, is that the absence of a pigment in the fossil doesn't necessarily mean that the pigment was absent in the living animal, right? That it could have been lost. And so, And so the colors presented, for instance, on Inkiornis are sort of a minimum set of colors, right?
I was just trying to think of, I was just there, because I'm not a vertebrate expert. I'm not an expert. I'm not a bird expert. And I was just there thinking, you know what? There's no white birds that I can think of. And then I was just like, oh, wait, swan. Oh, wait, there's quite a lot, Dave.
Yeah.
But there is a remarkable range of colors in modern ones. Is it likely, seeing as we're putting all of our money on the table and making these bets, is it likely that dinosaurs were going to be similarly multicolored, even if we don't have the evidence to be able to say so?
Totally. Again, I'm going out on a limb here, right? A little bit.
Yeah.
But I think that the feathers on dinosaurs were, I would strongly suspect, present in a wide variety of colors. Yeah.
Because you must use color for a whole range of different things.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm species recognition, display, camouflage, all of these things. Yeah.
And they must be as important back then as they are today. I mean, we've got raptors running next to each other. We've got a T-Rex courtship scene. Like, if those have colored feathers, they would help in every single one of those environments, wouldn't they? In situations.
Yeah. Absolutely. And the behavioral complexity of dinosaurs, I think, this is another thing that I'm just going to go out and say, was vast. And I think that, I used to be kind of a minimalist in that I put a great deal of weight on the behavior of primitive living birds. But the thing is, and also the coloration, right? Many, many, what we consider to be sort of basal primitive living birds are sort of drab, they're ground fowl, right? But I think that that is an error. And I think that it's because birds went through an enormous bottleneck at the extinction, at the Cretaceous, called the Cretaceous Paleogene extinction. And that the ancestral bird was probably actually a kind of pathetically little dumpy reduced version of what the prior radiations of near birds were and could have been. And so I went from thinking that, well, you know, something like Deinonychus was probably at least as stupid as, say, an emu. And emus are pretty stupid, right? Would be, would have been at least as stupid as emus are now, for instance. But I no longer think that. I think emus are descendants of early groundfowl that survived because they had low metabolisms and were able to eat trash and, you know, nested on the ground and didn't do anything interesting. whereas Deinonychus was in the middle of this long period of stability on Earth and part of a highly successful radiation in a time of abundance. And I bet that thing was really smart and really scary.
We can all hear a door handle turning. We can all see it.
I'm telling you, and the bigger ones too, because here's the other thing, right? The amount of processing power you need to control a body doesn't scale one-to-one with the size of the body. In fact, if anything, you need, the world becomes simpler and simpler as you get bigger. It becomes less three-dimensional, for instance, right? And so as you get bigger and bigger, your sheer number of neurons increases in a volumetric way, right? Which means to the power of three. And the amount that the stuff that you need to just do your basic functions, if anything, gets relatively smaller. So you've got more and more and more and more just brains sitting around with which to do things. So the really big dinosaurs had a huge amount of cortical neural tissue, of thinking tissue, that was just sitting there. And every time that's happened, in the history of life as we know it now from evidence from existing animals, you get really smart animals.
Wow.
Like, whale brains and elephant brains are not actually unusually large for the size of the animal. Whale brains are a little bit large. Elephant brains, I think, scale almost pretty much, you know, on the line. But they're really smart just because they're big. So think about that, too. Dinosaurs, you know, were quite possibly far more behaviorally complex than we minimally infer from things like living crocodiles and living primitive birds.
Oh, where do I go with that? That is a whole extra episode. A full episode of PaleoCast. We've been talking almost like 45 minutes in this. But yeah, we could do a whole extra series on the intelligence.
Well, we can have little, you know, little clips. Yeah. And animals can think with all kinds of parts of their brain too, you know, like we ourselves perform some of our cognition in our cerebella. Did you know that?
Which bit is our cerebella?
It's the little tiny wrinkly thing behind our brain that classically was thought to just assist with motor and balance functions. But it was right. Named cerebellum classically by ancient anatomists because it looks like a little brain. And it turns out that functional MRI studies show that when we're thinking with our big brains, a lot of the signal is mirrored in a small way in the cerebellum. And sometimes that cognitive functions can originate with cerebellar signals. So actually all kinds, and every part of the brain, you know, gets bigger in big dinosaurs. So they had all sorts of ways. When you just have all this excess brain matter, you know, you sit around and you think about stuff.
Wow. I did not expect this interview to go this direction. But I'm very glad it did. And I have always been a minimalizer of dinosaurs. I've never really felt that they would be particularly intelligent. And I hate in documentaries where they show, you know, where they give animals behaviors and human emotions where they don't normally have them. Yeah. And in a lot of dinosaur ones, you see like the communication between raptors and the coordination and all of these different gesturing motions and whatnot that they do. But I never really thought, you know, like that could have a basis in the paleontological science any more than it was just, you know, creative license and making something a bit more exciting for the audience.
It's definitely, I mean, you know, obviously some of it is wishful and much of it is probably way too mammalian, right? I mean, whatever they were doing, it was really alien, probably. Although really smart birds, like the smarter a bird is, the better it seems to be able to communicate in a mammalian fashion and the more it seems to be able to interpret mammals too. So maybe there is some kind of a cosmic convergence.
We got them talking now. Right, well, if the dinosaurs are going to start talking, then perhaps we should stop talking for this part and move on to the next. So thank you very much for this one.
Yeah, my pleasure.